This morning we will first hear argument in case 08305, Forest Grove School District versus TA. Mr. Feinerman.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. The 1997 amendments to IDEA prohibit tuition reimbursement awards for students who are unilaterally placed in private school without first having received special education services from the public school district. This is so under ordinary principles of statutory construction, and particularly so under the Spending Clause Clear Notice Rule. Prior to 1997, IDEA did not expressly address tuition reimbursement for unilaterally placed students. In 1997, Congress added Section 1412A10C. In subsection 1, Congress provided that when the school district makes a free appropriate public education available, a FAPE, no reimbursement is allowed. And then in subsections 2 through 4, Congress addressed situations where courts and hearing officers may award tuition reimbursement and said that reimbursement may be allowed where the school district does not make a FAPE available to a student who previously received special education services from the public district. Congress said
nothing. Mr. Feinerman, but the first provision that you read, sub 1, says that there will be no reimbursement if the agency has made a free appropriate public education available to the child and the parents elected to place the child in private school, but that if the agency made a free appropriate public education, and here, as I understand it, the school district said that this child was ineligible for special education.
That's correct.
So if the child was entitled to a free appropriate public education and didn't get it, then under this sub 1, wouldn't the parents be entitled to tuition reimbursement?
No. Subsection 1 covers students who are provided a free appropriate public education. Subsections 2 through 4 address the other category of students.
Well, those that's who are your, what's your construction, but couldn't this be read to say no reimbursement if, the word is if the agency, not, so the implication is if the agency did not make a free appropriate public education available, then
That might be the implication if there weren't subsections C2 through C4. So it's the TA's argument and the government's argument that C1 sets forth a general rule. But if that were the way that Congress meant the statute to operate, it wouldn't have had any reason to put in C2 through C4 because we would already know from C1 that tuition reimbursement was a possibility for students who did not previously receive special education services from the public district. Congress instead went on in C2 through C4 to address very specifically in the context of a comprehensive statutory scheme when tuition reimbursement would be available to students who did not previously receive. And Congress specified, after essentially being invited to do so in Burlington, which of those students could get tuition reimbursement.
Two through four don't limit or contradict any explicit requirement of one.
Oh, no.
One is only at most a negative implication, which one would not draw in light of two through four is what you're saying.
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm saying. And they deal with different sets of students. In one, the school district has made a FAPE available. In two through four, the school district has not made a FAPE available. No mention is made of when a FAPE is not made available to a student who had not previously received. And under this court's decision in Arlington, because those students like TA who had not previously received are not mentioned,
Then what happens in a case which I think is like this one, where the child doesn't receive special education because the school has determined that the child is not eligible? So the child isn't getting public education, and in the parent's view, confirmed by experts, the child is in need of special education, can't get it from the public schools because they declare the child ineligible. What is such a parent to do?
If it's an incorrect determination by the school district, the problem is remedied rather quickly. There are very tight time frames in IDEA.
Of course, the parents here didn't run off to a private school only after the school district had found that their child didn't require any special education, did they?
That's correct.
They put him in a private school without even consulting the schools.
Right, and then only after the fact went to the school district and asked
by the way, we can get some money. How much money are you talking about imposing on the school district?
Well, the tuition is $5,200 a month.
A month?
Yes, and then there's a $5,200 alumni services fee, a $1,500 interview fee. But
Mr. Fineman, can we go back to the time frame again? And I've just got a question of fact. I should know this, but I don't. You said that if the parents in the school district disagree, it can be remedied fairly quickly because there's a fairly tight schedule set for the administrative procedure. What I don't remember, and my question is this, when the administrative steps have been exhausted, if there is still disagreement, is there any limit on the time in which the judicial appeal has to be resolved?
No, there isn't.
Isn't that the kicker here? In other words, I fully understand your textual argument. I can see its soundness as a possibility that is open to us, and perhaps on the face of it, the most likely possibility. But there is a cost, and the cost, it seems to me, is that once you get into appeals, this thing can go on for years, and you can't wait years when a kid is in this kind of condition.
That's correct, but there's no need to wait years. Let's assume that parents actually went through the process appropriately, unlike TA's parents.
Can you explain what the process is? Because Justice Scalia said parents just went away. The school, at an earlier point, said this child was ineligible for special education. Isn't that so? I think
that's correct. That was in 2001, and the district judge at page 39 of the petition to the appendix to the petition, page 39, note 3, the district judge noted that the 2001 evaluation isn't an appropriate part of this case. But for the parents who try and get their student evaluated, the school district says no, the child is ineligible. And then the parents, at that point, the timing kicks in. The parents can ask for a due process hearing the next day. Under the time periods that were in place when TA's case was going through,
is that hearing on eligible or not, or is it on what the IEP should be?
Well, when
school has said not eligible, is that question resolved first before we ever get to the IEP?
I think in a situation where the school district finds the child ineligible and there's an appeal, both the eligibility and the appropriate placement are decided in front of the hearing officer. And there was a 45-day time period at the time TA's case went through for the hearing officer to make a decision. And then after that —
wouldn't the school say, we have no obligation to get up an IEP until the question of eligibility is determined?
I suppose if the school district were to get a stay of the hearing officer's decision pending appeal to the district court, but that's not what happened here. What happened here is that the hearing officer decided on January 26, 2004, that TA was eligible. On February 19th, quicker than the 30 days allowed, Forest Grove School District proposed an IEP. That could have started as soon as possible thereafter, as the regulations require. So you're talking about a very tight — I understand the situation that you're hypothesizing, Justice Ginsburg, but we're talking about a very tight turnaround in TA's day, 75 days, which is a matter of weeks, not a matter of years, as was the case in Burlington.
What happens when we get to court?
Excuse me?
What happens when we get to court? Isn't that when it turns into a matter of years?
It turns into a matter of years, but in the interim, the school district, Forest Grove School District, while it was litigating in the district court, Forest Grove School District offered an IEP, and at that point, TA's parents could have tried the IEP out, sent the child to receive services in the public school district.
They did the IEP after the hearing officer was finished?
Yes. Less than 4 weeks after the hearing officer was finished, Forest Grove offered an IEP, and that's in the addendum to our reply brief.
Okay, but I think we've got to assume that Congress had some concern for the parents who correctly say this IEP is no good. It just can't be done in the school system, and the kid needs a special school. And in that case, maybe your answer may be that's the exceptional case, and it shouldn't drive the inferences to be drawn from about congressional intent. But in that case, if the district and the parents are at good faith loggerheads, it can go on for a long, long time, can't it?
It can't go on for a long, long time if the parents file for a due process hearing, and then it could if they get a they
no,
get
but
an
they
IEP
get the due process hearing. The ultimate result is the school proposes an IEP. The parents, based on what their experts tell them, say that isn't going to work. And the parents say the only way, you know, we can educate this kid without his falling behind more is to put him in a private school. At that point, with assuming good faith here, it seems to me you get into court and it can go on for a long time if we accept your analysis of the text.
But all the parents have to do in that situation is to give the IEP a try and send their child to
public school. Yeah, but doesn't that get to the point of something pretty formalistic? I mean, somebody in the brief said, you know, give him one day under the IEP, and if you win, ultimately the check can be written, and that can't be right.
I don't think one day could be right. The statute says it expressly says who previously received special education services under the authority of a public agency. It doesn't say how long that has to be.
I
remember, perhaps incorrectly, from the prior argument here that the period that they had to try out the school plan was 10 days?
That's a discretionary factor that courts and hearing officers can — it's not a hard and fast rule, but I think it's probably good as a general benchmark.
So is that a period that your client's prepared to accept?
Yes, so long as — in the ordinary case, 10 days would — it's in the statute, so we have that textual indication. And it will provide the school district a chance to provide services under the IEP. And as this court mentioned in a prior case, IEPs, it's an exact science. And when you look at it on a piece of paper, it's hard to know whether it's going to work or not. The way you find out whether it works is where the rubber hits the road. And it could be that the parents look at the IEP and say, you know what, I don't think this is going to work. But until you actually give it a chance to work, maybe the child goes in and works with the special education teacher or the instructional assistant, and they really hit it off.
You think that's realistic? The parents are convinced going in that this is an inappropriate IEP, and they send the child to school for 10 days. Under the IEP, at the end of the 10 days, they're going to say, oh, well, we've completely changed our mind now. We think this is a good plan.
It's certainly plausible in certain circumstances. It may not happen every time. It may not happen half the time.
Isn't it also plausible that the district will say 10 days is not a fair trial for this system? This is a child with severe learning disabilities, and to give this IEP a fair chance, we need 10 months.
Right. At that point, those arguments can be made under C3 and C4, because at that point, the parents would no longer be categorically barred from seeking tuition reimbursement, and those are arguments that you can make to the hearing officer.
But you are basically saying that the only necessary delay in order to satisfy a condition for eligibility, if the parents otherwise prevail, is a 10-day delay. That's basically your answer.
I don't think I'm saying that.
The school does not have to come up with an IEP. It could tough it out and say we're going to rest on our belief that this child does not need any special education, right? And unless the school proposes an IEP, the parent cannot come within subsection 2 by sending the kid to get the special services.
Well, I think that assumes that the school district is not going to abide by the order of the independent hearing officer, and in our case.
But what about before? The whole point is there, under the words of the statute, as you have interpreted, there's a condition predicate that has to be satisfied. So to say that, to answer by saying, well, that assumes they won't obey the hearing officer, what about before the hearing even takes place?
Right. Before the hearing takes place, there is 45 days. Request for a due process hearing. The hearing officer has 45 days. And then if the hearing officer says this child is eligible, district, you must propose an IEP, the district has 30 days after that.
Well, what happens to do what? Case where to do what? Could the district appeal? That's the end of the road? Can't the district say the hearing officer is wrong?
Absolutely, the district can appeal.
And if it does it have to take any action in the interim?
I suppose unless it gets a stay of the hearing officer's ruling, but that didn't happen here, and I'm not aware of any cases where it did happen. In this case, there were two tracks. The hearing officer said, TA is eligible, prepare an IEP. The district said, I disagree, I'm going to appeal to the district court, but in the meantime, within less than 28 days, the district prepared an IEP and offered it to TA, and at that point, TA could have accepted the services, thus rendering him eligible for tuition reimbursement.
So just to get back to your answer to Justice Scalia, what if the school board just is adamant that he's not entitled to any special education and just maintain that position throughout the litigation?
I think the assumption is that the school district would not abide by a lawful order of a hearing officer.
Well, they got a stay and they wanted to appeal it. And if they did, what happened?
In that situation, there would be no, and I'm not aware of that situation.
They don't have a risk under your view of the law, as I understand it. They could take that position, and they would never be liable.
There would be a delay in that situation, but I'm not aware of any case where that situation, where a school district was obstreperous.
That's the consequence of your position, as I understand it, that they could do that. And they would not have any risk of liability.
I think that's a hypothetical risk, because, again, I haven't seen any situations where that's actually occurred.
Well, but it's not that hypothetical when there are two prongs. Number one, the school has to agree first with the diagnosis, in this case they didn't even do that. They had good faith disagreement. Second, they have to have an adequate IEP. So there are two conditions.
That's true, and I think the answer to the question this is really a legislative question. Perhaps Congress ought to further amend the statute to say, in those situations where a school district is being obstreperous and refusing to comply with the hearing officer's order, in those situations there's going to be an exception to the exception. But it's not the statute that Congress wrote. Congress
Listen,
wrote
your interpretation of the statute. Create an incentive for the school board to just say we'll never provide any kind of special education. We'll just tough it out.
If a school board
can't lose, they can't be liable if they do that. If I understand you correctly,
I suppose hypothetically it does. But in my understanding is that just doesn't happen in Schaefer versus Wiest and other cases.
Would you be surprised to find a court decision which says that? When the reason that the plaintiff cannot comply with the requirement that he first be in a plan, when the reason is the district's refusal to abide by an order to prepare a plan, that subsection 2 does not apply.
You
can't profit by your own by your own malfeasance.
That's correct, and I don't think there could be reimbursement under subsection 2, perhaps if there were a parallel Rehabilitation Act claim under 504. That might be a vehicle to get relief in a situation where the school district is acting as horribly as being hypothesized.
You don't think a court could say the only reason these people could not comply with 2 is that the school district made it impossible by not complying with the order to provide an IEP, and therefore they can recover for the private placement?
It's conceivable that a court could hold that.
I think it's more than conceivable. I know a lot of courts that would hold that.
But your position is that there are basically two situations. One, the situation in which there is an administrative order to do an IEP, and the school district says, no, we won't do it. Millions for defense. We're going right into appeal, and we're not going to prepare the IEP. In that situation, as I understand it, you're saying the parents have no way of getting relief under the statute. In the case in which there is an order for the IEP and the school district prepares the IEP, even though the parents think it will be inadequate, there, in fact, is a ready remedy subject to two delays. One, the time to prepare the IEP, and two, 10 days to give it a try before the parents take the kid out of school. That's basically the scheme that you're proposing that the statute provides. Is that correct?
That's the scheme that Congress wrote in the statute, yes. Under C-2, and it has to work that way because I want to come back to a point that was aired in the briefs, which is TA's argument and the government's argument rests upon the notion that Section 1415 I-2B-3 gives hearing officers the authority to award tuition reimbursement. That provision doesn't give hearing officers any authority to do anything, let alone to award tuition reimbursement. The only provision in IDEA that gives hearing officers the authority to award tuition reimbursement is 1412 A10 C2. So the statute doesn't work. The statute doesn't work, and the Secretary's interpretation of 1415 I2 B3 is implausible because it accords to hearing officers the authority that it doesn't have. There's another textual clue why the statute works in the way that I'm suggesting, and that is in the 97 amendments in subsections 3 and 4, Congress gave very explicit guidance to courts and hearing officers as to the factors the court and hearing officer should consider when deciding whether to award tuition reimbursement to a student who previously received special education services.
The problem that the government and the parents have is they have to give some work to double I. Under their view, double I doesn't seem to do much work. The problem with your position is that it seems in a way formalistic and in some cases to encourage intransigence. If we adopted a presumption that the school district's diagnosis was correct and a presumption that it's if there was a diagnosis of disability, that its individual education program was adequate, that would, it seems to me, not be all you wanted. It would ameliorate the position of the school district. Would we have authority, do you think, to adopt such a presumption?
I think the court already has adopted that presumption in Schaefer versus Wiest. School districts are presumed to be acting in good faith.
Well, this would be a clear and convincing evidence presumption that the IEP is, that the school district designs is right, that its diagnosis is wrong. That's not all you would be asking for.
Well,
but would we have authority to do that if we were to reject your interpretation of the statute?
I suppose you would have the authority to do that.
How have hearing officers been proceeding? I mean, here we had a case, went to a hearing officer. There's no IP when the hearing officer begins the process. On the eligibility or not, do hearing officers give deference to the school district? And then, so that's eligibility. At the IEP stage, do they give deference?
There's some deference given to, you're talking about the deference that the district court gives to the hearing officer?
The hearing officer. The hearing officer is the first level decision maker. And the school board gives its reasons why it thinks the child is ineligible. The parent, the reasons that the child is eligible. That's the threshold determination. On that threshold determination of eligibility, do hearing officers presume in favor of the school district?
Not in this case. In this case, under Oregon law at the time, and this was a pre-Schaefer decision, the hearing officer put the burden of proof on the school.
Counsel,
on the question of eligibility.
Why isn't it the case that the school's diagnosis is a related service under the statutory provision? It seems to me to be a very important service to the parents to know what the school's diagnosis is.
I think that the diagnosis is more in terms of eligibility. It's under under B6. The hearing officer can decide, can consider issues of identification, eligibility, and placement.
Well, I'm talking about what the parents received, and they receive a diagnosis, and the statute covers, asks whether they previously received special education and related services. Diagnosis would seem to be a service related to special education.
I don't think that's the way it works. A finding of eligibility or not is not a diagnosis. It's just an eligibility finding, and that's something that the parents can take to a due process hearing under 1415F. If there are no further questions, I'll reserve the remainder of my time.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Sammons.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. The school district in this case improperly denied TA, a child with a disability who had always been enrolled in public schools, access to all public special education services. It asserts that because its wrong eligibility determinations prevented TA from receiving special education services, it is immune from reimbursing TA's parents the cost of obtaining those services from another source.
What's wrong with 10 days? I mean, it's a big expense you're asking the school district to incur that will take away funds from other programs. And all they're saying is give it a try for 10 days, and if it doesn't work out, then you can go.
I think there are several problems with that reading of the statute, Your Honor. First of all, the 10-day period that's referenced in subsection C3 refers to the amount of notice that a district needs to receive before a child is removed from
the first day you say, look, we don't think this is going to work out, so we're notifying you what we're going to do. And they say, well, you've got to do that 10 days. And they said, okay, 10 days.
But that's simply not the way these things work as a general matter. Let me just point out a few things about the normal process of developing IEPs. And again, here the child never even got that far. But typically IEPs are developed at the end of a school year for the following year. And the parents at that point have a period of time in which to decide to go along with that plan or to give notice and then make alternative arrangements. And it's simply and that's the way it works. And because it's important for parents to be able to get their child in an alternative program if they decide that's what they want to do. And if you wait until the school year has already started, those may not be available. And the 10-day notice requirement.
No, I suppose that's right. But once the law is clarified, schools that specialize in treating these kids would be able, they'd understand as well. And they'd understand you've got to, the people who are going to be sending, most of the people who will be sending their children to the school have to wait 10 days. And it seems to me that the actual practice on the ground would work out pretty easily.
But again, Your Honor, if you focus on the terms of the statute, even under petitioner's reading, the requirement would be to have previously received special education services, not to have tried out a particular plan. It may be the case that the plan for the upcoming year is very different than the plan for the prior year. Perhaps they'd had another assessment and they had substantially changed the
proposed. Which way does that cut? Seems to me that cuts the other way. Here's a new plan. We've worked on it. Here it is. At least give it 10-day, two school week tries.
I think the way that cuts, Your Honor, is that that reading of what you were positing, I guess, in this exchange, what Congress might have had in mind, it's not what they said in the statute. They did not require parents to try out a particular plan, just that at some point in time they had previously received special education services.
With respect, counsel, what Congress provided is that the child must have previously received special education and related services.
That's right.
Well, I think they did provide that you've got to try it out at least for a minimal period.
But not the particular plan that's the subject of the IEP, Your Honor. That connection does not exist in the statute. And we think it's counter to what Congress has.
Well, so what type of special education services do you think do count as having been previously received?
Well, if I may, the way we read this provision, and it's set forth on pages 3 and 4 of the addendum to the blue brief, and we think it's important that we read this as a whole and in context, is that subsection C1 provides the general rule to govern the payment of private school tuition based on a unilateral placement by the parents. And subsection C1 creates the only express limitation on the right to reimbursement, and it does so only in instances where the school district has provided a free and appropriate public education. We think subsection C2, C3, and C4 work together to govern the subset of cases that Congress was most concerned about and that, in fact, are the most common scenario in which these disputes have arisen.
Except that you're reading C1 to say something that it doesn't say. It just says you don't have to pay if the agency has made a free, appropriate public education available.
That is
and
what
you read it to say you must pay whenever it hasn't made. And it just doesn't say that. It's a safe harbor for the school district. It says so long as you've made an appropriate public education available, you can't be liable for any private school tuition. Now, you want to expand that to say, and whenever that condition doesn't exist, you are liable. But it really doesn't say that, and the later sections suggest that it meant not to say that.
Well, that's where we part company, Your Honor, because, in fact, that negative inference that you referred to is precisely what petitioners attempt to read into subsection C2. There's nothing in subsection C2 that provides any restriction on the ability to obtain reimbursement. It is written
well,
permissive
in reading,
language.
In reading it that way, you are reading the phrase, who previously received special education services, to mean also who previously did not receive special education services.
No, Your Honor. We are simply not reading that language, who previously received, to be a condition precedent.
So if it doesn't matter whether they previously received or not.
It does matter, Your Honor, because the provisions that follow in C3 and C4 that guide the exercise of discretion in that category of cases that were of concern to Congress only apply to the cases that are defined in subsection C2. And so in our reading, the language who previously received still serves an important purpose, but it serves an identifying purpose for the limiting factors provided in C3 and C4.
So you're saying Congress went to the trouble of spelling out this elaborate provision in C3 and 2 and all the other things, but that was not the universe of the situations in which there could be reimbursement. They went to that trouble, but then at the end you want to say, or some other provisions, or some other circumstances.
Well, that's right. We think that Congress was focused on a particular set of cases where problems had arisen, and that's where you already had a child in the process of receiving special education, and you had parents who removed the child out of that process without giving adequate notice, and thereby short-circuiting an ongoing collaborative relationship that Congress wanted to preserve.
Yeah, but if you avoid that collaborative relationship entirely and just run off to a private school right away, you get reimbursement. Why?
Well, you don't automatically get reimbursement. You don't automatically get reimbursement, Your Honor. There's just no categorical bar to seeking reimbursement. You still have to show it's an appropriate remedy, which always has been understood to require a showing that the parents acted reasonably and in good faith, and that they were sincere in their efforts to obtain services from the school.
What about
the alternative?
More than that? Why not? I mean, suppose the part I don't understand in this statute, which may not be relevant, I would appreciate the help. It seems to me that A, 10, large A, and then F have something to do with a parent who never goes to public school. The child just goes to private schools to begin with. And they get something. If they have a disability, this program pays them something.
I'm not following this. I don't know what section.
It's at the very beginning on addendum page 1.
Okay.
This is what's known as the child fine provision.
And what it
provides is that let me just step back for a moment and remind the court that the obligation on the state is to ensure that all children with disabilities, regardless of whether they're in public or private school, have the opportunity for a free, appropriate public education. With respect to children in private school who are not seeking a free, appropriate public education from the public school district, the only requirement under the Act is that you seek them out, you find them, you identify them, and that you report that to the Department of Education, and that you get money for those children. And for those children that are not enrolled in public school, you have to use a percentage of the funds you
right.
receive
so,
from the federal
so
government
in other words,
to provide benefits that are available
parent
to all children.
A parent who has a disabled child who never thinks about the public school system still gets some money, but not as much for the disabled child.
It's not money to the parents, Your Honor.
It's money to the school.
It funds programs, for example, speech therapy or something
the school.
That they would then allow children in private school to benefit from.
So it's money that goes to the school for a program.
It's not even necessarily money that goes right. to the
money
private
that the
school.
Children
it,
can
it goes
go,
to
I
the
get
public
it.
Schools that they provide services that they may make available to children regardless of their
all right. Now,
of their
it, would it then work? What is it, would this system work under the statute? You say parents, if you're going to a disabled child, you simply go to a private school. You get the services you just mentioned. Now, if you put the child in a public school and they find a free, appropriate public education, fine, that's the end of that. You have to do it. Now, if they don't give you a decent one, you can send the child to a private school, but you have to give a shot to the public school system. Now, that's what you don't want the interpretation to be.
Well,
don't you're against that, but let's amend
that's
it a little.
Not, I would not describe it that way, Your Honor. If I don't mean to interrupt.
Well, I'm reading the language. You may require the district to pay for someone who has been enrolled in special services.
I mean, again, just keep in mind the facts of this case. This is a child that was in the public school system.
You haven't heard my amendment.
Okay, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
My amendment is: the norm will be give the public school a shot. But there could be circumstances you're getting the runaround. There is need to put that child in a public school now. In other words, special equitable circumstances that make it reasonable for the parent not to give the school a shot, though that's the norm. And in those unusual circumstances, there would remain grounds for equitable relief. What about that as an overall interpretation of the statute, which has several parts to it?
I would submit that the way we read the statute, Your Honor, in fact, does precisely that. Because the school district, just again, take this case.
You have to be willing to accept that it's an unusual situation, though it may well exist, that the judge is going to reimburse the parent where that parent didn't give the public school a shot. They'll have to show there's a good reason for not doing that.
The difficulty
is that all right
have,
with you or not?
Well, the difficulty I have with your question, Your Honor, is that the school district always has a shot under the Act. In this case, the school district assessed the child in 2001 and again in 2003. And both times, it erroneously concluded.
Well, you're simply saying that it was reasonable for the parent here. I'm not asking that question.
No, not just that it's reasonable, but that in the process of assessing the child and developing an individual education plan that is appropriate for that child, that is precisely the shot that the statute gives the public school system to get it right.
Mr. Kalman, I thought that the courts, the district court, will not provide for tuition reimbursement unless at least two things are shown. One is that the school district did not provide an adequate education for this child, and two, that the private school did. And then there are equitable considerations.
That is absolutely correct.
So you must find both, not just that the private school was a good place, but that the school district did not offer an adequate education for the child.
That is correct. That's what this court held in Carter. That's what the regulations say. I would note that there's nothing in the text of the statute and the provisions that petitioner relies on, C2, for example, that makes it a statutory requirement to show that the private placement is reasonable as a condition precedent to obtain tuition reimbursement.
No.
But both sides concede that that's required,
but
even though it's not in the statute.
We know that there's a provision addressed to a court for equitable relief. The question was put before, where does the hearing officer get the authority to order tuition reimbursement? Because the statute on which you rely for the court speaks only to the court's authority.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm happy to answer that question, but petitioner makes this a centerpiece of their reply brief, and I think they just misread the statute. And again, keep in mind that these amendments in 1997 were written against the backdrop of this long-standing statute and this Court's interpretations of it. The most direct place where the statute provides hearing officers the authority to address reimbursement claims and to award reimbursement, and this is on page 9 of the addendum in the blue brief, is 1415B6. This has always been in the statute, and it states that the parents must be provided an opportunity to present complaints with respect to any matter relating to the identification, evaluation, or educational placement of the child, or the provision of a free, appropriate public education to such child. That is, again, that has always been understood to include the right to seek reimbursement before the hearing officer. And this Court in Burlington cited legislative history from the 1975 Act that noted that hearing officers could award reimbursement and address such claims, in concluding that it was part of the appropriate relief that courts ought to be able to have under 1415.
Are any of these other procedures? I took these to be procedures that have to be provided by the school district, not by the hearing officer.
These are required. This whole section, Your Honor, 1412, is entitled State Eligibility. And these are all requirements that states have to provide for process in order to obtain funds under the Act. And so it is a requirement that states provide hearing officers that have the ability to award reimbursement.
Well, it doesn't say hearing officers, an opportunity to present complaints with respect to any matter relating to identification.
Those complaints —
to present the complaint to the principal.
No, Your Honor. This is a reference to the due process complaint notice that's referenced elsewhere in the statute. I believe petitioner would agree with me that that's what this reference is.
No, but the reference is to a right to be heard on certain subjects. It doesn't say anything about authorizing a particular individual or officer within a school system to award relief. The problem is it says you can be heard. It doesn't say who will tell you or who will tell the school district to write a check.
Right. But keep in mind that the judicial review process that the statute provides, and this is at page 17 of the addendum, the right to file a federal action is limited to those matters that are raised in the due process complaint notice filed before the hearing officer. This is an exhaustion.
Well, but you can raise the claim to eligibility to a private education here without the hearing officer having the authority to order the school district to provide it.
That has not been the interpretation of this Act, Your Honor, and I would refer the Court to 34 CFR 300.148B, which is a regulation that states that hearing officers can award reimbursement, and that has been around since the mid-1980s. My point is that the Congress enacted these amendments in 1997 against a settled understanding of how this Act works, and it has always been understood that hearing officers can award reimbursement. There was no need to provide in the 97 amendments that hearing officers can also award relief. And again, because it's a exhaustion requirement and the judicial review provision only relates to the things that you've raised before the hearing officer, it makes no sense to say a court can award reimbursement, but you can't get reimbursement from the hearing officer. That's the subject of the review of the federal court action.
No, but it might make sense to say that the hearing officer can determine eligibility. It is then up to the school to pay it. And if the school does not pay it, then you've got to go into court and get an order.
In fact, Your Honor, the hearing officers have always been permitted to award reimbursement, as occurred in this case. And then the school district can decide either to pay that or to seek review if they so choose.
Well, and it might make also sense to say that if the hearing officer has no authority to award a certain type of relief, neither does a court under that general provision
But, of course, this Court in Burlington held the Court did have that authority, and it relied on the fact that it's always been understood that hearing officers have that authority in reaching that conclusion.
That's right. But with these new provisions, if the hearing officer doesn't have the authority to award the kind of relief that was awarded here, then the Court wouldn't either.
Well, with respect, I think there's nothing in the 97 amendments.
Well, you agree they go, as we say, in pari passu?
Well, I do think that it doesn't make sense to say
whatever the hearing officer can do, the court can do.
I think generally,
and whatever he can't do, the court can't do.
I think they ought to be read together, yes, Your Honor, but I think they ought to be read to provide for the authority to provide tuition reimbursement. One statutory point I would like to make, Your Honor, is that under petitioner's reading of the Act, if you read C2 to be that reference to who previously received to be an absolute precondition, then I think it's the case that C1 has no meaning whatsoever. It does no work under the Act at all. Whereas on our reading of the statute, C2 still does work. It's not a precondition. It doesn't do the work that petitioner suggests. It does a more limited, serves a more limited function. But it still serves that identifying role for the factors Congress wanted applied when it was focused on how to preserve relationships, ongoing collaborative relationships through the IEP process that warrant preservation. One other point I would make, Your Honor, and Justice Scalia, you made reference to this principle of equity that you ought not be allowed to prevent something from happening and then come into court and claim, ha-ha, they didn't satisfy a condition. And that was a point that was made by Justice Cardozo in the R. H. Stearns case that we rely on, where he said, he who prevents a thing from being done may not avail himself of the non-performance which he himself has occasioned. That is precisely what happened here. As this case comes to this court, it is established that this is a child who was entitled to receive special education services back in 2001. The only reason he did not receive those services is because the district violated its statutory duty.
I thought it, in 2001 even the parents agreed that he didn't, that they didn't want to put him in special education.
The parents agreed, Your Honor, that he did not qualify for the learning disabilities that they tested him for, but they had an obligation under the Act. And this was found by the hearing officer, and the complaint that was filed within the 2-year limitation to challenge that 2001 determination, and that was error. They had an obligation to test him for those other health impairments at that time.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Miller?
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, had petitioner provided TA a special education that was later determined to be inadequate, there would be no question that the district court would have authority and discretion to determine whether an award of private school tuition reimbursement was appropriate. Petitioner's view is that because it offered no special education at all, it is therefore categorically immune from such an award. That position is not supported by the statute, and it's inconsistent with the reasonable interpretation of the Secretary of Education. There is no basis for reading the statute to create what effectively would be an incentive for districts to stonewall and to say that if they don't —
Well, for 10 days, right? Even assuming the bad faith that you're ascribing to the school district, that would only work for 10 days, right?
Well
— And then they would have — then they would have previously received special education services, and they could proceed.
We're not assuming bad faith. Our point —
Stonewall sounds to me like bad faith.
Well,
that was the word you used.
Congress, there's no reason to suppose that Congress would want to create an incentive or to reward districts that do that.
But you're talking about two different things. I think the Chief is talking about putting the child in special education and keeping the child there for 10 days. You are talking about the school district that says no special education. This child is not eligible.
That's absolutely right. So in a case like this, there's nothing to try for 10 days because the district has found him not eligible. They haven't offered any special education or related services. Now, to the extent
— Well, let's move to the situation where they have a plan that the parents regard as inadequate.
In the case —
In that situation, all they would have to do is to have the child try the plan for 10 days.
Well, if the — You know, to the extent that there's an interest in having parents try out the plan, petitioner's reading of the statute is very poorly tailored to that objective because it doesn't require that they try the specific plan that's being proposed for 10 days. Even under petitioner's reading, the statute simply would require that the child at some point have received some special education and related services. It wouldn't have to be under the plan that was being tried.
But the odds are that it would be under the plan. I mean, what you say is theoretically possible, but in the real world, it's probably going to be under the plan, isn't it?
Well, not necessarily, because there's a new plan at least once a year under the statute, and they're typically proposed at the end of a school year for the start of the new school year. So there wouldn't be, on petitioner's reading, a requirement that you show up for the first 10 days of the new year. You would just have to give notice after the IEP is proposed in May or June. You give your 10 days notice, you received special education services under the old plan, under the previous year, and on petitioner's reading, the statute would be no barrier to reimbursement there. Now, of course, the district courts do have considerable equitable discretion, and we're not suggesting that reimbursement would be mandatory in that case or in any case.
And the parents, I think you agree, the parents would have the burden of showing both that the school did not provide an adequate education, an appropriate education, and that the private school does.
That's absolutely right. And they would also, in our view, have to show the district court that they had genuinely cooperated with the public school in making their child available for evaluation and cooperating.
Suppose we thought it were sensible to add to that burden the further rule that the school district is presumed to have made the correct diagnosis and, if there is a plan, if in that kind of case, that the plan was adequate and that the parent would have to show by clear and convincing evidence that this is not so. Rather than just inventing it and pulling it out of the sky, is there some authority in the statute that would give us warrant to do that, or are there any cases that would give us warrant to establish a presumption of that kind in order to recognize the longstanding expertise of the states in this matter and in order to allow Section 2 to do some work?
Well, a clear and convincing evidence presumption would be difficult to reconcile, I think, with 1415I2 C3, which says the district court decision should be based on the preponderance of the evidence. But it is certainly within the district court's discretion, and it would be within this court's discretion, I think, to prescribe principles to guide the exercise of the district court's equitable
discretion. But the district court doesn't get into the act until the hearing officer is done.
Right.
And so it would be odd to have a presumption applicable in court that isn't also applicable to the hearing officer, because the court is reviewing a decision by the hearing officer.
Right. Well, I think the standard in both stages of the proceeding is by a preponderance of the evidence, and the parents, as the party challenging what the school has done, have the burden. But at both stages, it would be appropriate to consider whether they were genuinely seeking a free, appropriate public education. And I think it would be entirely appropriate and consistent with the preponderance standard for the hearing officer or the court to take due account of the fact that the school district has some expertise and to give some deference to what it's proposed.
I2B3.
It's I2B. It's been amended in 2004. There's no change in the language, but it's now I2B.
It's now C?
C.
C3.
Does the department have a regulation that says the hearing officer may order the private school, the parents, to be reimbursed for private school tuition? This is not in the statute.
34 CFR 300.148B says that disagreements between the parents and a public agency regarding the availability of a program appropriate for the child and the question of financial reimbursement are subject to the due process hearing procedures. So, yes, that regulation gives hearing officers the authority to award reimbursement, as indeed the hearing officer had done in Burlington. Burlington was a case where the reimbursement award was made in the first instance by a hearing officer, and of course the court held that was appropriate. And
counsel, this is spending clause legislation. Do you have any rough idea of how much of the obligation incurred by states is reimbursed by the federal government? What percentage?
I think of the additional costs of treating special education children above those of educating other children, I think approximately 10%, 10 to 12% is reimbursed by the federal government.
So if this interpretation vastly expands the liability of school districts in that particular area, isn't that a consideration we should consider? Since the states accept 10% of the funds to incur these obligations, and then you're expanding the obligation in a way that we may at least find is ambiguous. Isn't that a pertinent factor?
There's no basis for supposing that there would be a vast expansion of liability, and that there are some statistics on this in the National Disability Rights Network's amicus brief at pages 13 and 14. Of about 6 million children in the United States who are receiving special education, barely 1% of those are in private placements, and the vast majority of those are agreed-upon placements between school districts and the parents. So this sort of unilateral private placement is quite rare because, of course, the parents do it at their own financial risk. And so there's a real barrier to parents doing it because they have to be pretty sure that they're right and that they're going to be able to meet the demanding standards of satisfying the district court that an award of tuition reimbursement is appropriate. And if they don't do that, they're going to be
— If the parent's entitled and the child's entitled to the special education and the school doesn't give it, and there are two schools, private schools in the community, A and B, A charges, what is it, $5,200 a month tuition. The other is considerably less. They both have adequate programs for the child. Is the hearing examiner entitled to reimburse only for the lower amount?
Right.
Or is the parent entitled to send the child to the more expensive school?
No. What this court said in Carter is that it's appropriate for the hearing officer to take into account whether the cost of the private education was unreasonable. So in a situation where you had two basically equivalent schools, that would certainly be an appropriate thing for the hearing officer to take into account in limiting or denying reimbursement.
Well, there could be, I suppose, an order that any tuition in excess of a certain amount would be the parent's responsibility.
That's right. That would be within the discretion of the hearing officer. And in a case like this where you have a residential placement and the residential component of it, there's been no suggestion that that was had some educational purpose or was part of providing an appropriate education. It would also be appropriate for the court to decide to disaggregate that and say we're only paying for the school district only has to pay for the educational component.
Let me be — am I correct that under the theory of the statute that you're supporting, it would be possible for a parent without first consulting with the school at all to put the child in a private school and then later to request public school services, and when they are denied or they are inadequate, all that public school private school tuition would be reimbursable?
There would be no categorical bar in the statute in that situation, but a district court confronted with those flat facts would most likely conclude that the parents had not genuinely sought a free, appropriate public education and hadn't appropriately cooperated with the school district.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Feinerman, you have 4 minutes remaining.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. I'd like to address the two provisions that we've heard today for the first time. TA and the government are resting their argument that tuition reimbursement is permitted in the unilateral placement context to students who had not previously received. The regulation 300.148, council reference subsection B, disagreements about FAPE, and it does say that the hearing officer can consider the question of financial reimbursement. In the very next subsection, C is entitled reimbursement for private school placement, and that provision speaks only to students who previously received special education and related services
with the authority
of the public agency. This regulation was brought up at argument. It's not in any of the addendums. But I would direct the court's attention to subsection C of 300.148. In terms of the provision that TA's lawyer addressed, 1415B6, no argument. There's no argument in the briefs that 1415B6 gives hearing officers the authority to grant tuition reimbursement in these circumstances. The Department of Education did not rely on this provision when articulating its commentary that tuition reimbursement is still permitted under these circumstances. The Secretary of Education relied upon the 1415I2B3 provision that, of course, refers only to courts. And even if the argument were properly presented, which it isn't, it would be subject to the same dynamic that's in play with respect to 1412A10C2. You have a very general provision giving hearing officers authority. Congress got specific in 1997. There's a heading, enacted a provision under the heading reimbursement for private school placement. I think that clearly indicates that's where Congress intended to repose the authority of hearing officers to order tuition reimbursement to unilaterally placed children. We also have and it just doesn't work to say that 1415 I2B3 somehow gives hearing officers authority, even if it were interpreted that way prior to 1997. In 1997, Congress enacted the statute that expressly referenced hearing officers and courts and allowed both of them to give tuition reimbursement. So even if 1415 were interpreted prior to 97 incorrectly, we would submit, to give hearing officers that authority, after 1997, where Congress actually went to the trouble of saying hearing officers and courts can give tuition reimbursement in certain circumstances, that prior interpretation, whatever its merits back then, no longer is
valid. What happens if the hearing officer can't? But why couldn't a court? I mean, they see an unusual situation. The parents were justified. And it doesn't say there are no circumstances other than where they may not pay. So the judge says, I think this is a situation where it is inequitable. It is equitable to pay the reimbursement.
That's correct. But
why not? What says you can't do that other than your basic point about the may require?
The spending clause, the headings that Congress used.
But anyway, the regs don't say anything.
It's a system that doesn't make any sense because for children who did previously receive and go to the hearing officer to challenge either an eligibility determination or an improper IEP, the hearing officer could award tuition reimbursement. But for children who didn't previously receive and then they went in front of the hearing officer, they would have to, I don't know what the word would be, appeal to the district court in order to get tuition reimbursement. Is it conceivable that
you're saying the statute says the hearing officer can't do that no matter what? It's a separate argument.
That's correct. But I'm saying if TA is right, that would be the system. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. The case is submitted.